You will now please turn with me to John's Gospel, John chapter 8. We are continuing to make our way through this book of the Bible, John chapter 8. We're going to begin our reading this morning there in verse 31. Be a shorter passage than we've been considering in recent weeks, but we'll be reading verses 31 through 38. And if you found your place, if you'd like to, or if you'd like to use a pew Bible, I should say again, that's page 894. But if you would, please stand if you're able for the reading of God's Word. John chapter 8, beginning with verse 31. Hear again the word of the Lord. So Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, or had believed him, if you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. They answered him, we are offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free? Jesus answered them, truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed. I know that you are offspring of Abraham. Yet you seek to kill me because my word finds no place in you. I speak of what I have seen with my father, and you do what you have heard from your father. As for the reading of God's holy word, you may be seated. Some of you will remember the radio personality, news personality and commentator Paul Harvey, especially his signature rest of the story segments and bidding his audience good day as he signed off. Perhaps you can still hear his voice as he would say that. Once he told of a fascinating story of how wolves, how Eskimos kill wolves. I almost said how wolves kill Eskimos. It's the other way around. It's how Eskimos kill wolves. They would dip a sharp knife in blood, and then they would freeze it, and then repeat the process, making kind of a blood popsicle for wolves. They would dip it coat after coat of blood and freeze it each time, and then they would take the handle of the knife and place that in the ground. And so that the blade was exposed, when the wolf comes along and begins to lick this knife blade covered with frozen blood, his warm tongue, of course, would begin to melt the ice, and it would get closer and closer to the blade. And the ice would serve as a bit of a numbing agent so that the wolf wouldn't realize that soon the blade was cutting into its own flesh and continuing to lick. The blade, it wouldn't realize that it was tasting its own blood. But because of the wolf's insatiable appetite for blood, it would continue to lick, not knowing that it was harming itself and that the blood it was tasting was its own. By morning, the wolf would be dead. The wolf is hopelessly bound by its own nature, and in this case, bound by its own nature to its own destruction. Being bound is not something that we like to talk about or think about. We value freedom as American citizens, and rightly so. Liberty is one of those inalienable rights the founding fathers of this nation noted in the Declaration of Independence. It is something worth fighting for. It is something that has been and continues to be worth dying for. But as wonderful as it is, as wonderful as freedom is, as awful as bondage is, we can boast of being free men, all the while being ignorant to how natural man since the fall is bound to his own insatiable appetite for sin, bound to his own nature and the damage that it does to ourselves and those around us, and that it ultimately leads to death. Dale Ralph Davis says that sin is not just guilt, it is grip. It controls. It claims. It's an alien power that dominates. Well, Jesus is speaking of a particular type of bondage, a bondage to sin here, and the path to freedom from sin. At the end of last week's passage, we saw in verse 30 that as Jesus was speaking, you remember he's proclaiming himself, likely still at the Feast of Booths, he's in Jerusalem, but proclaiming himself to be the light of the world, his opponents are objecting to this. They're saying that you are testifying about yourself. You said that the testimony was not yours, but the Father's. Well, Jesus reminds or proclaims to them not only that he is the light of the world, but that his testimony is true. Even if he is speaking of himself, he's speaking what is true, but also the Father has testified to of him as well. And as he goes on to speak of what he has heard from the Father and what has been revealed to him and what he is sharing, we saw in verse 30 that as he was saying these things, many believed in him. Verse 31 opens up with Jesus speaking to those Jews there present in Jerusalem who had believed in him. We don't know the ratio of believers in Jesus to opponents of Jesus in this crowd. We know that both are present. He speaks to the believers, and yet it's his opponents who speak out, who take issue with what he had to say. But as he speaks to those Jews who had believed in him, he makes clear what being a true disciple of his is, which we'll see as we get into the text. But he also takes the opportunity to tell his audience, those who believed in him, as well as those opponents of his, and by extension, us, as we hear these words as well. Unless we recognize our true and hopeless condition as a slave to sin, as bound by our own nature that leads to death, then we'll never be truly free. As much as political and economic freedom as we might have, to be ignorant of this is to never be truly free. But the good news is Jesus tells us what true freedom is and where it is found. And in this passage, what I want you to see this morning is just this, that true freedom, very simple truth, but very profound. True freedom is found in being a disciple of Jesus. That is the simple truth from these verses this morning. True freedom is found in being a disciple of Jesus. I want you to see this in three parts. We'll see in verses 31 and 32, first of all, the course to freedom, or a path to freedom, the course to freedom. We'll see in verses 33 and 34 the counterclaim to freedom. As Jesus speaks of how he can set those free who come to him, there are those who say, wait a minute, we don't need you to set us free. We have our own freedom. So there's not only the course to freedom, but the counterclaim to freedom. And then finally, verses 35 to 38, the Christ of freedom, or the Christ who frees us. The course to freedom, the counterclaim to freedom, and the Christ of freedom. Let's go back to verse 31 now and see the course to freedom. Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, if you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. In his statement, we find a course, a path to freedom. It is also briefly a description of the nature of saving faith. This is what saving faith looks like. If you will, look at it with me in reverse. If you go to the end of verse 32, we find freedom comes with the knowledge of the truth. And the knowledge of the truth comes from being truly Christ's disciple. And being his disciple comes from abiding or remaining in his word. So again, remaining in the word is to be a true disciple of Christ. And being a disciple is the knowledge of the truth, and the knowledge of the truth sets us free. He's speaking again to those, remember, who had believed in him in Jerusalem. He wants them to understand it's not just those who begin well, or begin who start out with a fit, or have a great display of what it appears to be faith. It's not just about beginning well. He says, if you abide in my word, if you remain, then you are truly my disciples. The nature of true discipleship is this, that it abides, it remains in the word of Christ. We're getting close to the new year, of course, which is always a time for a fresh start. And I don't know about you. Well, I'm sure this is true of most of you, if not all of you. Like me, are you looking for a fresh start in 2021? There does seem to be this notion that January 1st, things are going to kind of go back to normal. I don't think that's quite the thing that's going to happen. But New Year's are it is always a good time to refresh. It is a time to think back, to evaluate on where we have been, on where we are, and where we're going. A new beginning. People eat healthier. You can't find a parking spot at the gym. Christians begin Bible reading plans. And these are all, of course, worthwhile goals. Healthier diet, getting some exercise, spending time with God in His Word. So always a good time to evaluate and to reevaluate. Of course, I don't have to tell you, do I, the disappointing statistics regarding New Year's resolutions and how many people actually keep them. A few years ago, on December 31st, someone posted online that if they were going to keep their New Year's resolutions for that particular year, it being December 31st, they had less than 24 hours to do those things. Less than 24 hours to learn a new language, read 52 books, lose 15 pounds, and learn to play the banjo. We don't keep them very often. Perhaps like the person whose goal this year was to lose 15 pounds. And now that it's December, they say, I've only got 20 pounds left if I'm going to achieve my goal. Maybe some of those descriptions describe you. So many begin well. The question is, who remains? Who abides? That's what Jesus is telling us here, that true disciples are those who remain. Who continues? Who finishes the race? We've already seen in John's gospel the problem of a pseudo faith, of these spurious converts. If you remember back in chapter 2, where those in Jerusalem who believed in Jesus, they are described as believing in Him, but Jesus did not believe in them. He did not commit Himself or entrust Himself to them. He knew that what was in man. He didn't need anyone to testify to the nature of this faith. It wasn't true. Or we go to John 6, where the multitude had been fed by Jesus, and they come the next day believing that He is able to perform a miracle. But we find, as Jesus said, it's not that they're after Him, but only what He can give them. They're returning to Him because He filled their bellies the day before. So we've already encountered this in John's gospel. But I don't think, as some suppose, I don't think these words from Jesus here are meant to discourage. I don't think that He's speaking only to those opponents of His who didn't have true faith. But I think He is speaking to those, as we find in verse 30, who did believe in Him. The words that He says here don't have to be a discouragement. They are indeed a warning. Yes, if you do not remain, if you do not abide, that you are not a true disciple of Christ. But they can also, not only are they factual, but they can also be an encouragement to provide strength to weak hands, to take courage, to keep going, to persevere, not to lose heart, to take hold of Christ and abide, remain in His Word. That's what Jesus says a true disciple is here. Remain in, be fed by the Word. It's the Word of Christ. That's where you're taught by your Lord. That's where the truth is revealed in and by Him. This is how you learn to follow Him. This is how you know you're one who has been admitted to Jesus' company. Is that you're one who follows Him in this way, by abiding in the Word. We ought to make clear, though, it's not that we become a disciple through our perseverance, but rather, perseverance is what proves the nature of our faith. The nature of saving faith is just this: it abides, it continues, it perseveres. This is the course to freedom. This is the way, Jesus says, to be set free through the knowledge of the truth, being His disciple, following Him in this way. That's not all we see here. Verses 33 and 34 give us, though, as we've seen, the course to freedom that Jesus prescribes here. There is also the counterclaim to freedom. The counterclaim to freedom. Just like so much of what Jesus has said up until this point, his opponents take issue with it. And in taking issue with what Jesus says here, they really show that they're blind to their true need. They can't believe what Jesus said. They're in denial. Look at verse 33. After he says this about being a disciple truly and the truth making them free, they respond in this way. Verse 33, they answered him, "We are offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free?" And sin truly can have this effect on us, can it? A blinding effect. Someone points out an issue in our lives or in our speech or in our patterns of thinking, we immediately respond as they do here. "How dare you? You have gotten me all wrong. I'm not who you think I am. You're way off base. You're wrong about me. That's not the issue at all." And so they're asking, how dare this man? Can you believe the audacity here that he would suggest that we, the Jews, that we, the offspring of Abraham, need to be made free? This is ridiculous. But we read this, if you know anything about the history of the Jewish nation, you may read this and think, how can they be so dull? This seems to lack any self-awareness here. Politically speaking, the New Testament scholar D.A. Carson reminds us that there was scarcely a major power whom the Jews had not served. You think of Egypt, their bondage there, their captivity to Assyria and Babylon. And then in the intertestamental period, they were in subjection to Greece and Syria. And in this very day, Rome. Of course, there was relative freedom under Rome. They had some religious independence under Rome. But politically speaking, they could not deny that they had actually been enslaved to many foreign powers. They seemed to think too highly of themselves. Because of that obvious truth, this obvious gap, people think they couldn't have been speaking of political enslavement and political freedom here. Perhaps they were speaking spiritually, and maybe so. They thought of themselves, regardless of who was over them, as sons of the kingdom. Jesus makes this reference in Matthew chapter 8. One popular rabbi of the time said that all Israelites were king's sons because they were all the offspring of these great patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jesus, of course, is not speaking of political enslavement. He's not talking about that type of bondage. He's speaking of another type of slavery. The slavery that Jesus is speaking of is the worst type of slavery. It has the most serious consequences. And it's deceitful. It's deceptive. You can be enslaved in this way and not even realize it. You can think you are free. You can say, I do what I want. I'm not shackled down by rules, by religious rites, by moral obligations. Jesus says here, the one who practices sin, in verse 34, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin. The practice of sin both enslaves and proves one's bondage to sin. So that ultimate bondage which Jesus is speaking here is not political, it is not economic, but it is, as Carson puts it, it's bondage to moral failure. It's shameful self-centeredness. It's a devotion to created things over or in exchange for devotion to the Creator. It's rebellion against God. These Jews denied their need to be made free. They denied their bondage, and men may deny it just as much as they did here. But as much as they try to deny it, as Jesus is telling us here, natural man is held captive by his enslaving corruptions. He is powerless to free himself. He needs the truth. He needs the Son to set him free. And sin is the most cruel taskmaster. It is a tyrant. It pays its servants with the wages of misery and death. Enslaving. You can deceive others. You can even deceive yourself, as these opponents of Jesus were here, into thinking that you are free. But if you are outside of Jesus, if you're outside of Christ, then His words, Jesus' words here, should awaken you and should shake you to the core. They should cause you to feel the bonds sinking into your wrists and the weight of the chains and the shackles pulling you down, keeping you in servitude and captivity. Natural man, since the fall, is in bondage to sin. He is in need of emancipation to be set free. So we've seen the course of freedom. We've seen the counterclaim to freedom. But finally, as awful as that is, we find here the Christ of freedom. This is the one who frees us in verses 35 to 38. Now at least verse 35 and 36 are a little difficult to interpret, but I think what is, let me read them for us. The slave does not remain in the house forever. This is right after he says everyone who practices a sin is a slave to sin. He says in verse 35, the slave does not remain in the house forever. The Son remains forever. So if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. There's the word Son is used here, but it seems to be referring to different people. So it's a bit difficult to understand what is being referred to here. But I think the key to interpreting what Jesus is saying is in their claim to be the offspring of Abraham, because he returns to that again in verse 37. I know that you are offspring of Abraham, yet you seek to kill me because my word finds no place in you. He goes on to speak of his father, what he has seen and what he reveals from his father. He says, you hear and you do what you've heard from your father. He's not speaking about Abraham there, though. We'll see next week, Lord willing, who their father truly was, spiritually speaking. But I think it's key, or I think their reference to being Abraham's offspring is key to understanding what he says here. Not only is the one who practices sin a servant of sin, but the slave does not remain in the house forever. They claim to be Abraham's offspring. When Jesus immediately mentions this, no doubt it would come to their mind that Abraham had two sons. There were both Isaac and Ishmael who could claim to be his offspring. But one was the child of promise. The other was the son of the Egyptian handmaiden, Hagar. The other was the child of the servant. And so when the child of promise was born and was raised, this covenant promise and the lineage that is to continue through him, that was reserved for Isaac. And so there came a time for the servant to be cast out of the house along with her child. The son is the one who will receive the inheritance. See, it was possible to be in the house and to benefit from the privileges of belonging to the house, but to remain a slave and not a son. There remains a need for those in the house to be set free. And the only way to be free is by the Son who is in their midst. They can claim to be a son, but if they are practicing sin, they are actually slaves of sin, and they will be cast out of the kingdom, cast out of the covenant, cast out of the house. But the Son from heaven has come now to set them free. And this is the way to freedom, the Christ who frees. The problem was that Jesus and his opponents were sons of differing fathers. He of the heavenly Father, and they of their father, the devil. And this is what he'll say in the remainder of the chapter, proving that, yes, I know you are Abraham's offspring, physically descended, that is your lineage, but that is not your spiritual ancestry. If they would be free from the chains of sin, free from servitude, free from slavery, free from bondage, they must be set free by this son, the seed of Abraham who is in their midst. Jesus alone can free from sin, and true freedom is found in being his disciple. Jesus not only is the son here, not only does he enjoy this position as son, but he has authority from the Father to liberate captives to sin. And the freedom that he gives is a true freedom. If the Son, he says in verse 36, if the Son sets you free. We're all familiar with Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech where he said, free at last. But here Jesus says, if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. Indeed, it is a true freedom. Free indeed. Not free to do what we want, perhaps, but free to do as we ought. We might ask, well, what is this freedom? What is the nature of this? What does it mean to be emancipated from slavery to sin? It is freedom. Freedom from the sentence of guilty for breaking God's law. Free from sin's dominion and mastery. Free from the prince and the power of the air, Satan. Free from the evil of afflictions. Yes, we are continually afflicted. But even in our afflictions, God promises to work all things together, even our afflictions, for our good. And so the evil of them is removed as they come to us filtered by our heavenly, loving Father and His good and perfect plan, and according to His promises. Free from the sting of death. Jesus has taken it. Free from the power of the grave that can only hold our bodies for a time. Free from the everlasting curse and wrath of God. In short, free from sin, free from its guilt, its power, and its consequences. Free access to God as our Father, who hears us when we call upon Him, who answers our prayers, free to love Him with all of our heart and soul, mind and strength, and free to love our neighbor as ourselves. If the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. This is a true and the highest form of freedom. And yet, sadly, sometimes believers submit themselves to the tyranny of sin voluntarily. To do so is a failure to enjoy the liberty that Christ has purchased for us. Because it's not a hypothetical liberty. It is a true liberty. And so we put ourselves under bondage when we bow to sin. Or when we live in as though sin's consequences had dominion over us. That is to say, at times we might live in fear or terrorized, always catastrophizing, if that's a word. The worst that is going to happen, but a failure to know and to believe the promises of God. And if we find in ourselves, because of our natural inclination, what we are drawn or tempted to, or because of our circumstances, if we find ourselves falling prey to these things, these are areas where we need to be more vigilant. We need to keep watch. Because as the apostle says, sin shall not have dominion over you. If the Son sets you free, you are free indeed, really and truly free. You don't have to submit. Yes, we continue to battle with indwelling sin, but you don't have to submit to its tyranny, to its bondage any longer. Addiction does not have to have dominion over you. Pornography shall not have dominion over you. Fear, anger shall not have dominion over you. If the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. And there is a course to freedom by abiding in His Word and being, in this way, proving as a true disciple of Jesus Christ. True freedom is found there in being a disciple of Jesus. Liberty is a wonderful thing. J.C. Ryle notes how it is the highest, or one of the highest, of all temporal blessings. Again, worth fighting for, worth dying for. He says, think in these words: freedom from oppressors, a free constitution, a free press, free trade, civil and religious liberty. These words provide a world of meaning and possibilities. It's something that many would sacrifice life and fortune to achieve and maintain for ourselves and for our children, for our posterity. And of course, it is a topic at the forefront of many of our minds as we see what seems to be our liberties being encroached upon. It is something we should be concerned for, but at the same time, we must remember that liberty, as wonderful as a blessing as it is, liberty and the pursuit of it, like any of God's gifts, can be an idolatrous pursuit. Because we can boast in being, again, free men, but how pitiful would it be for a man to boast in his freedom, in his liberty, as Jesus' opponents did here in these verses that we have read, all the while being ignorant to their true bondage, not knowing the highest form of liberty that only Christ can give. Someone has said that a man's worst difficulties begin when he's able to do as he likes. So it's not a freedom to do, again, as we want, but as we ought. True liberty, as counterintuitive as it sounds, is found by taking Christ's yoke upon you, by being bound to Him. He says, "My yoke is easy and my burden is light." There you will find true rest for your soul. This is true liberty. The Son sets you free. You will be free indeed. Let's pray.